Welcome to Conversations on Healthcare with Mark Maselli and Margaret Flinter, a show where we speak to the top thought leaders in health innovation, health policy, care delivery, and the great minds who are shaping the healthcare of the future. This week, Mark and Margaret take a look back at some of the best shows of 2018 and the amazing guests who joined us, from Dr. Lloyd Minor, Dean of Stanford School of Medicine, and Dr. Steve Klasko, CEO of Jefferson Health and the Jefferson School of Medicine, both of whom talk about the need to recruit more creative thinkers in healthcare and training for a team-based approach to healthcare. Intermountain Health's Dr. Charles Sorensen talks about their integrated care delivery model, telemedicine, and the Leadership Institute he directs. CareMore Health CEO Dr. Sachin Jain discusses the high-touch approach they apply to their Medicaid and Medicare patients, yielding much better results. And Aetna President Karen Lynch discusses the merger with CVS. Microsoft's Noella Charity talks about the future of voice and AI in healthcare. As always, you can find us wherever you listen to podcasts or ask Alexa to play the program. Now, let's listen back to some of our favorite guests from 2018 on Conversations on Healthcare.
Well, Margaret, we made it through another interesting year here on Conversations on Healthcare. 2018 has brought us some dramatic twists and turns. We've seen the big vertical mergers between entities like Aetna and CVS, and the rise of tech innovation like CRISPR, gene editing technology, and so many other interesting trends are emerging. Voice technology like Alexa has started to be explored as tools to address some of healthcare's biggest challenges. Some really terrific guests, though, this year, Margaret.
We've also seen a real growth this year in the development of coordinated care delivery models like CareMore Health and CityBlock Health, systems that seem to really get that they can leverage technology and team-based approaches to bring care into the homes and really the lives of patients. So that's an approach I think we're going to hear a lot more about in the coming year.
Indeed. And there have been some really promising developments in genomics and in bioscience. One of the more fascinating stories to emerge in this past year is the rise of CRISPR technology, targeted gene editing technique that's going to revolutionize the way we treat and prevent disease. CRISPR scientist Samuel Sternberg joined us earlier this year talking about the promising potential of this tool. Really, just quite remarkable.
You know, for so long, we've been limited by relying on random mutations as a way of being, you know, the work stuff of evolution. And now with tools like CRISPR, scientists have the capability to go into the genome, which is made up of DNA, and make pinpointed precision changes to that genetic material. And so that could really change the way that scientists think about treating disease in human patients, in editing the DNA of plants and animals that we rely on for food and other kinds of industrial biotechnology. You know, already we've seen a complete transformation of the way that biomedical research is being done because of the ability to now go into the genome and make changes as a way of designing better experiments. And really, virtually any sector of biological research can be now studied better with tools like CRISPR.
And scientists have set their sights on another daunting task. The Human Cell Atlas is a global scientific effort to map every single cell in the human body. Co-chair Avi Regev joined us on the show, talking about the dramatic technological advances that are now allowing scientists to pick up where the Human Genome Project left off.
Just like the Human Genome Project was a project to find the genes, which are one part of the periodic table of elements of the human body, the Human Cell Atlas aims to find all the cells, which are another set of elements of the human body, except that there are 37.2 trillion of them. Together with the huge size of the human body, I think really underscores how difficult this can be. And until recently, we could only really analyze multiple cells at once, maybe millions or tens of millions of them together. Now we have new techniques that allow us to look at individual cells. You can think of it as new microscopes that allow us to look at cells. We can really take on this challenge of the trillions of cells that are different from each other and are organized throughout the body.
Her co-chair on the Human Cell Atlas, Dr. Sarah Teichman, elaborated on the complexities of this process and how many disciplines are involved.
And single-cell genomics is one of them. And the excitement there is really the revolution that's taken place in genomics, where we can now study DNA and RNA nucleic acids in individual cells. And so that's, an incredibly exciting. And that revolution is also going to the spatial level where we can study cells in their spatial context. And So the technologies are genome biologists, I would say technology developers.
And speaking of advances in all of these areas, Dr. Eric Topol of the Scripps Translational Institute joined us on the show again. Eric is a world-renowned cardiologist, as well as an expert in genomics, and he is a personal medicine evangelist, I think we can say. His institution is providing vital support to the National Institutes of Health All of Us Precision Medicine Initiative.
It's called the Participant Center, which is all the participant-facing technologies, like their apps, the website, data going back to them that they generate through their sensors or through their DNA. And also, we're responsible for enrolling hundreds of thousands of participants. So we have a lot of responsibility at this Participant Center, but moreover, it's to keep the engagement throughout decades ahead for each of the million and likely much more than a million people. You know, we're going to be getting a lot of the folks who wanted various sensors. Like, we already started a pilot with blood pressure watches, trying to find out what is really promoting engagement along with useful data collection.
2018 seems to have been the year of the vertical merger, large industry players coming together to address cost and the inefficiency in healthcare. Pharmacy giant CVS acquiring insurance giant Aetna. Aetna President Karen Lynch joined us on the show and predicted mergers such as this are going to change how patients interface with their healthcare experience.
Clearly, this is a transformational merger, and it gives us the opportunity to reshape the healthcare industry. You know, the way I think about it, for too long and far too often, we've been practicing sick care, not healthcare, and the potential of a CVS-Aetna merger is really to organize around the consumer and around the consumer experience. It'll allow us to be in the local communities, to create another gateway to access healthcare, and it also will give Americans a go-to destination for their healthcare services and their healthcare needs. CVS has over 10,000 stores across the United States, which means that 70% of Americans live within 5 miles of a CVS. You know, how this will help facilitate improved access is really to understand that your zip code is more important than your genetic code. And what that means is your individual behaviors and your environment clearly have meaningful impact on healthcare costs. So I want you to imagine a local CVS being an interactive hub where individuals can come in and learn more about their healthcare, and they can have further assistance in navigating the overall healthcare systems, where we might point people to different providers and point them to social services in their communities to address the social determinants of care. And our overall goal is to achieve affordable, high-quality care for the individuals that we serve.
Technology is poised to have a big impact. Harvard Medical School's Chief Information Officer, Dr. John Halamka, talks about the enormous potential of artificial intelligence as well as genomics-driven insights. But he also sees a huge untapped potential in developing telemedicine protocols throughout healthcare and advancing them.
So I do 900 telemedicine consultations a year. I am credentialed by Harvard to practice telemedicine, telecare, and malpractice insured. And what do? I am the nation's expert on poisonous mushrooms and plants. And so whenever a child or an adult has a poisonous mushroom or plant problem, poison control gets involved, I get typically an image sent to my iPhone. Here is the mushroom. Here is the symptom. And then I will say, that is this particular variety. This is the solution. And we treat the patient. But here's a challenge. I am licensed to practice in Massachusetts. What if I suggest that a medication needs to be given immediately, but I'm not licensed to practice in the state where the medication is given? And so this is where we just need to work on the regulatory framework. Can I use my Massachusetts licensure to ensure a medication is given in North Dakota? Well, at the moment, no. But think about it. At low cost, in real time, you're getting to the nation's expert with the best advice.
Wow.
And that is clearly something we want to do more of.
And Margaret, Dr. Halamka is also a big fan of the potential for Alexa's voice technology application for the future of healthcare, demonstrating one of the skills he's creating at Harvard and Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center in Boston.
Alexa, ask BIDMC, what is my care plan for today?
I'm not sure.
Well, here, you know, I must have been a little too close with the phone and the mic. We've done 30 Alexa skills. And those are such things as, you know, when's my next dose of medication? When will my doctor see me? Get a nurse. These sorts of things. And they work really quite well. But Alexa at the moment isn't covered by a business associate agreement. Amazon does, by the end of the year, plan to have business associate agreement coverage so you can actually transmit protected healthcare information over Alexa. But for the moment, you know, the experiments we have done really aren't transferring things like your name or things that would be used to personally identify you. And so we probably are safe with the early experiments. But huge potential for the technology.
Try Alexa one more time. It may have just been just waking up.
Sure. Alexa, ask BIDMC, what's my care plan for today?
Your care plan for today includes, at 8 a.m., a blood test to measure glucose level and blood count. At 1:30 p.m., an x-ray. At 4:45 p.m., your doctor will be checking in.
Well, there you go.
Well, that is perfect.
And, Mark, that also speaks to the interesting work being done by yet another outstanding guest that we've had on the show. Noel LaCharity is the principal developer for Applied AI and Cognitive Services at Microsoft. After leading a team of developers building hundreds of voice skills for Alexa, she sees enormous potential for machine learning to evolve dramatically in the healthcare arena, and that future generations will not only expect but demand voice interface with their healthcare system as they do with technology. I think this will just be normal business.
So the nice thing is you go to Alexa today and there are dozens of blueprints. I'm a huge fan of learning by doing. And so these code snippets are fully functional, right? Granted, one of them is like about space facts and, you know, they're not about the content, but all the code is there. So I always encourage people, like, just go, and you'd be shocked with zero technical skills. If you know how to follow instructions, you could build a skill for the first time, publish it to 10 million Alexa users and have never built code before. I have many, many people that I work with that do this every day that are like, oh my gosh, I can't believe I just built a production app. And even Alexa today will even host your app. So you don't have to worry about infrastructure or how to do it. The most important thing today is thinking about how can you create content and create an experience on Alexa that your users will want. And the nice thing, of course, is that today people are more tolerant than ever because voice is just still very cool. But another place to see speech and voice integrated with other technology kind of more holistically is in the AI school. So there's this free online school called AIschool.microsoft.com, and it infuses speech. We have skill development, all of these technologies kind of coming together to create scenario-based applications. Now, these are a little bit longer, right? The blueprints you can do in an hour, these are more like eight-hour projects. But you end up with a portfolio of work that you can literally claim that you've built. So it helps you refine your resume, add these skills to your toolbox, and just get super excited. And of course, you know, I'm always trying to share all of this. There's a Channel 9 on YouTube with the AI show. So we do some YouTube, you know, esque versions of these. But it's all anything you could do to immerse yourself in this. If you have a desire to build, the technology is definitely available and ready for you to do it.
We loved her energy, her enthusiasm, and her knowledge for this space, Margaret.
Brilliant insights. It's really advanced the field.
Technology is great, but healthcare at its core is about interfacing with human beings. So we've become really interested in innovative care models that focus not only on high tech, but high touch as well. And I think it's that combination of the two that is rife with great potential as we seek to improve care delivery and outcomes. Dr. Sachin Jain is the CEO of CareMore Health, a health entity that deploys teams of community workers, health coaches, traveling doctors and nurses to meet vulnerable patients where they are. You know, it's really amazing. They are really focused in on reducing hospitalization in chronically ill patients, improving the quality of their lives, targeting things like proper nutrition in the home and addressing loneliness and isolation among older populations, especially.
Mm-hmm. I think one of the key enablers of the CareMore model is the fact that the chassis on which we're built is not a fee-for-service chassis. Mm-hmm. We are built on, you know, with a notion of full delegation of risk, meaning we get paid a per member, per month, you know, risk-adjusted payment for the care of our patients. and we are fully responsible for all of their healthcare expenditure. So because we have a high level of loyalty, our patients don't leave us. So we're not playing the game that a lot of insurance entities play, which is not being concerned about, you know, longitudinal healthcare costs. Our average member stays with us for 9 years. So we're investing. We're spending more money up front than we're often being paid, with the idea that long term, our patients will have fewer medical complications, a slower progression of disease, fewer acute episodes of illness. You know, the average acute episode of illness lands somebody in the hospital and costs $12,000 or $15,000. If you were to take that money and actually reinvest it in prevention, which is what we do, you get phenomenal outcomes. And that's how we're able to provide transportation to our members, because we know that that's one of the barriers to access to care. That's how we're able to provide post-discharge meals for patients who don't have food at home when they get discharged from the hospital. That's how we're able to deliver a togetherness program, which focuses on providing social interaction and engagement for our most socially isolated members. That's how we're able to provide a Nifty After 50 gym, which focuses on senior wellness and exercise. You know, those are expensive interventions, but they're far less expensive than sending a patient to the hospital for an ICU admission.
All of this reminds me of yet another guest, Aya Ram, the founder of City Block Health, which is a venture with Google's parent company, Alphabet. He's building a tech-enabled ecosystem that embeds deeply within urban communities where social determinants of health pose real challenges to good health outcomes. They're linking people and their healthcare system to housing, to food, to the social determinants of health that we've known for so long have such a huge impact, and trying to empower whole households and perhaps whole neighborhoods to improve their health.
An average hospitalization, which is going to shift a little bit market by market, accounts for those or hours of the community care worker, but also accounts for significant transportation, or one of my favorite statistics, 2.5 years of food stamps for a family of four. When you think about the opportunity for meaningful investment of those factors that underlie the health of a population, I think it's very clear that we have opportunity to reinvest. So we believe, and I think many models in this space have demonstrated, that you can reduce total acute utilization, emergency department spending, and inpatient hospital spending on the order of 35 to 40%. So one thing that's worth noting about individuals who have significant health challenges, they are significantly more likely to be admitted from an emergency department into an inpatient setting. Even though with models like ours that can support them out in the community, that can provide wraparound services to help them be healthy, when you show up in the emergency department, hospitals are very good at getting you into their beds. On the specialty side, folks that move across the healthcare system that don't have the empowerment to advocate as effectively for themselves as others might often have pretty significantly outweighed specialty spending. And on the pharmacy side, there are a variety of pragmatic factors here that I think are really important to consider. We had a member recently who had recurrent emergency department utilization, who made really smart choices to access the emergency department at the end of every month to get a 30-day refill of insulin, because they knew that the emergency department would ration that out to them at the end of every month. And the reason for that is because they had a $350 copay on that insulin medication. And so being able to find ways to intervene around the cost of pharmacy services, and also where it creates very meaningful barriers to care because of the lack of use of a generic, drives recurrent and preventable emergency department spending, I think is really powerful.
You know, we'll check in on Aya over the next couple of years, Margaret, looking forward to see how that model scales up. All of this change in tech-enabled care delivery, telemedicine, coordinated care model means that the nation's teaching institutions have to rethink how they're training the next generation of healthcare professionals. And like Dr. Lloyd Minor, Dean of Stanford Medical School, who says they're taking a much more interdisciplinary approach to medical training to meet the demands and opportunities of the 21st century healthcare.
The need for physicians and other health professionals to understand what can be accomplished through data science, that need is increasing prodigiously. And during the first 2 years of medical school, we basically follow the same calendar as the rest of the university. So we have first and second year medical students taking courses in computer science and engineering, as well as in the humanities and social sciences. Medical students get combined degrees in law or in business, as well as in more traditional scientific disciplines. Today, more than ever, the need to train physicians to be valuable members of teams. We also want to have physicians graduating from our medical school that have competencies in other areas as well. I like to think of what we're moving into in healthcare as being high tech, enabling high touch. I don't believe that healthcare professionals are going to be put out of business by high tech. When we ask people in our healthcare delivery system, do you want to receive all of your care virtually? Or do you want to have a primary care health provider and be able to access others virtually? No one elects to eliminate a primary care provider, but they also want the immediacy that virtual interactions and digital health provide today. Those of us who are responsible for training the healthcare workforce of the future, that's what I think we want to focus on.
We gained some similar insights, Mark, from Dr. Steve Klasko, who's CEO of Jefferson Health, which oversees the Jefferson School of Medicine. He says we must train the clinicians of tomorrow to be absolutely comfortable collaborating in teams, something that hasn't been traditionally done in medical schools, but of course is part of the air we breathe here in community health.
That is for sure.
So, you know, one of the cool things about Jefferson is we were the first medical school in the country that thought seeing humans would be a good idea. We had the first Center for Interprofessional Education. What my entire research life has been is the fact that we still accept medical students based on science GPA, MedCats, on organic chemistry grades, and somehow we're just amazed that doctors aren't more empathetic, communicative, and creative. So what we're doing here at Jefferson is from the first time that a medical student literally starts their studies, they are basically surrounded by nursing students and pharmacy students, you know, without really even knowing where they are. So before we have a chance to teach them to be arrogant or, quote, give orders or be captain of the ship, they're learning to be a teammate. So we believe that that makes a difference. What I hear from residency directors all over the country is that our students understand teamwork better. Think about this. We are the only discipline that requires extreme technical and teamwork competence that never checks your technical and teamwork competence.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the combination of using simulation to create great teammates before we start to look at ourselves as captains of the ship and to recognize that you're going to have to continue to get your technical and teamwork competence assessed like pilots or folks in nuclear power plants makes a lot of sense. And I think Jefferson's leading the way.
And we want to particularly call out the work of Dr. Don Warren. He is a physician and director of the program called Indians into Medicine at the University of North Dakota, really doing a tremendous job of both recruiting Native Americans into medicine, where they are very disproportionately not represented among the future physicians of America, but also doing research and educating people to the impact of history and historical trauma on the future health of generations, really just doing terrific
work. Such important work.
As a nation, we need to come to terms with the American Holocaust. The American Indian population was almost completely wiped out because of deliberate efforts to kill American Indians. And if we are ever going to get to health equity, where we can actually raise health to appropriate status for every population, we have to contend with the truth. And I see a reluctance to do that because it makes people feel bad.
Mm-hmm.
And the truth is, there was deliberate attempt at genocide of American Indians. People may have heard of Amherst, Massachusetts, or Amherst College.
Mm-hmm.
It's named after Lord Jeffrey Amherst, who was a colonial governor. And he is the one who ordered the distribution of blankets from a smallpox hospital to the northeastern tribes with the purpose of killing them. So our first documented case of bioterrorism is our own colonial government. But that's not taught in our history books.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that what I see is that people blame the victims. They don't understand why we have such high rates of addiction or diabetes or cancer. And, well, from my perspective, if you want to get to equity, you have to walk through truth.
This, of course, was the year that the Theranos scandal broke wide open. Tech startup that claimed to be revolutionizing diagnostic testing, able to test for hundreds of diseases with just a small drop of blood. There was so much excitement about that. Wall Street Journal writer John Carreyrou conducted an in-depth investigation and found that not only were these false claims, but the company was actually putting patients at risk for real harm.
She came to have this very powerful board of older men, and that gave her credibility with the investors that she conned. She targeted billionaires and billionaire families, among them Rupert Murdoch, who invested $125 million in the family of Betsy DeVos, our current education secretary, which put in $100 million. The heirs of Sam Walton put in $150 million. So really, that's how it unfolded. And then what's going on now? Well, she's been charged with fraud by the SEC, and she negotiated a settlement without admitting wrongdoing. But there's also a criminal investigation spearheaded by the U.S. Attorney's Office.
You know, his exposure led to the shutdown of the company, which at one point was valued at $9 billion. And speaking of corporate greed and real harm, the opioid crisis has exploded in recent years. Longtime New York Times journalist Barry Meyer had been investigating the role of Purdue Pharma in the rise of the opioid crisis. The makers of the opioid painkiller OxyContin discovered the company lied about the drug's potential harm and marketed the drug aggressively, helping set the opioid crisis in motion.
I think it's important to bear in mind that the FDA's approval of OxyContin, the actual language that was used, was that OxyContin, because it was a time-release form or long-acting form, is believed to pose less abuse liability than traditional short-acting drugs. So that is believed was the language that was approved by the FDA. That is, it might be less prone. What Purdue did is it basically took this unique claim, one that had never been given to any drug before, and ran with it.
Yeah.
So basically, they were given a gift by the FDA.
Mm-hmm.
So what they did was they trained their salespeople to basically go out and lie and tell healthcare professionals that it would produce less abuse and addiction. So, you know, there was an internal decision made by this company to basically deceive doctors and lie to doctors.
His book, Painkiller, is a cautionary tale of what happened when drug manufacturers mislead the public.
And speaking of writers, we had a delightful conversation with New York Times science columnist Carl Zimmer, whose terrific book, She Has Her Mother's Laugh, examines the history of heredity and how our growing understanding of genomics will only enhance our greater understanding, not just of health, I love this part, but of humanity.
I do think that clinicians just really have to practically start over with their education because so much has changed so quickly. And the patients are going to be coming to doctors with results they're getting from direct-to-consumer services as customers. And they're going to say, look, 23andMe says I have this. What are you going to do about it?
Yeah, they already are.
Yeah, exactly. And so, you know, you need to learn how to talk about, for example, risk. There's a big difference between a mutation that guarantees you're going to get Huntington's disease and a mutation that slightly, on average, increases the risk of heart disease. And yet it's hard for people to recognize it. If it's there on the report, they think it's all the same. Clinicians are going to have to really get to understand lots of very common diseases are influenced by hundreds or thousands of different genes. You know, there are these approaches known as polygenic risk scores that are going to be coming more and more into practice.
And as we embark on 2019, our 10th year of doing this show, we'll be keeping our eyes on the continuing emerging trends, the Affordable Care Act, which is where we started, Margaret, with our show. The Affordable Care Act has just been dealt a legal blow. A Texas judge has ruled the whole law is unconstitutional, and that's throwing much confusion into the mix. We're going to keep an eye on that. There will be likely more give and take on health policy discussions, and we'll watch with interest as such things as telehealth and precision medicine approaches begin to take hold in the healthcare arena.
And if it's making news in the healthcare arena, particularly innovations in policy, technology, and healthcare, you'll hear about it right here on Conversations on Healthcare.
You've been listening to Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Mark Maselli.
And I'm Margaret Flinter.
Peace and health.
Conversations on Healthcare is recorded at WESU at Wesleyan University. streaming live at chcradio.com, iTunes, or wherever you listen to podcasts. If you have comments, please email us at chcradio@chc1.com or find us on Facebook or Twitter. We love hearing from you. The show is brought to you by the Community Health Center.